Let's get started then. So last time I've introduced Hubbard-Sartorius noise transformation, which I used to rewrite the partition function of Ising model in terms of functional integral. So let me reproduce one intermediate step of that transformation just to talk a little bit about the meaning, the physical meaning of this field phi, right? So the partition function looks like this. It's sum over all spin configurations and then integral over phi's, e to minus 1 over 2t, sum over I and j, phi I, j I j inverse phi j, and then plus 1 over t, sum over I, phi I, sigma I. So if you compare this thing here with the mean field Hamiltonian, right, then it's clear that so this field phi basically has the meaning of the fluctuating molecular field, right? So if you look back at the mean field Hamiltonian for the Ising model, the molecular field couples to the spins precisely in that way, right? As B molecular times sigma I, right? So except in mean field theory, this is just a constant parameter, right? While here it's a fluctuating field, okay? So the physical meaning of phi I is basically fluctuating molecular field. Okay, so then if you sum over sigma I, we get this representation of the partition function of the Ising model in terms of functional integral. So, I mean, for now, this is not really a functional integral. This is just a multidimensional integral. But when we take continuum limit, it's going to, when you go from the lattice to continuum limit, it's going to become a functional integral. So I'll just call it functional integral. Okay, e to minus s of phi, where s is the action. And so this is equal to 1 over 2t, sum over I and j, phi I, j I j inverse, phi j, and then minus sum over I log of twice hyperbolic cosine of phi I divided by t, okay? So far, this is all exact, and evaluating this integral is absolutely no easier than calculating the partition function of the original Ising model, yeah.
So going back to this molecular field, so mm-hmm. when we defined it originally, we defined it in the mean field, using the mean field theory.
That's right.
Yeah. So we defined it after we had decoupled all the spins, right, and we just couple them to the kind of net magnet relation.
Right, yeah.
So, I guess maybe could you say a little bit more about this connection between the phi and the molecular field?
Well, you said it exactly correctly. Technically, what mean field theory does, it decouples the interaction between the spins, right, and presents the Ising model in terms of spins coupled to some effective field, right? I mean, this is exactly what Hubbard-Sartorius does as well, right? It decouples interaction between the spins, but so unlike mean field theory, which is not exact, which is an approximation, and the approximation there is basically that this field is just uniform and constant. And it's a parameter of the theory. We minimize the free energy with respect to this parameter and find its optimal value, which minimizes the free energy. Here, So it turns out that you can do something very similar, but exactly, right? However, that field, which decouples the interaction between the spins, right, you know, has to be a fluctuating field, which fluctuates, well, not independently, but so there has to be a field, separate field on each side, right, and that has to fluctuate.
Field is the same at each lattice.
Well, yeah, exactly. So, I mean, that's coming now. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So again, so evaluating this integral exactly is just as impossible as solving the Ising model, right? But the point is that we can sort of do more controlled approximations in evaluating this integral. Okay. So in particular, mean field theory, as I will show now, is equivalent to evaluating this integral in a saddle point approximation. Okay. So let me just briefly remind you what saddle point evaluation of integrals means. So I mentioned it last time, but let me just say it again. So suppose I want to calculate this kind of integral. Integral from minus infinity to infinity dx of e to minus f of x, where f is some function of a real variable x, right? And suppose that f has a single minimum, has a single global minimum at zero. Okay, so suppose f has a global minimum, so the global minimum at x equals 0, right? So then what I can do is expand f in Taylor series around 0, right? So this is going to be approximately equal to f of 0. The first derivatives are going to vanish because this is a minimum. And then, so the leading term is going to be 1 half f double prime of 0 x squared, and f double prime is positive because it's a minimum, right? And then I can do this integral, right? And the reason that it's a good approximation is that, you know, the integrand has a very strong exponential dependence on x, okay? So then I get that I is approximately equal to e to minus f of 0, and an integral from minus infinity to infinity dx e to minus 1 half f double prime of 0 x squared, right, which is a simple Gaussian integral. So this is equal to then square root, I guess, of 2 pi, so 2 pi divided by f double prime of 0, and then e to minus f of 0, okay? So mean field theory is just equivalent to calculating this integral using exactly this trick. Yeah. Well, so I'm going to show that if I do the same thing here, then what I will get is mean field equations that we've derived before.
Right.
Right.
Okay. So in the mean field theory, we had an equation for magnetization. Right.
Right.
But in this case, a priori, I don't see how would you get an equation for a magnetization.
Well, I will get an equation for phi.
Which
has a meaning of molecular field, right? So it's going to be equivalent to equation for molecular field, which, you know, in mean field theory is just proportional to magnetization. It's J times the magnetization.
Okay.
Right?
This is a global minimum, right?
Yeah.
But you could do the same thing around a local minimum as well.
Well,
if
in that case, you know, so if there are several minima, then I guess what you should do is just sum over all the minima, right? I'm just assuming for simplicity there is a single minimum. Okay. Well, unless if you have a global minimum, single global minimum, right, and then all the other minima are very far away in value from that global minimum, then all you need is just contribution of that single minimum. If there are several minima at roughly the same value of f, then you better sum over all of them, right? So there will be a separate contribution from each minimum to this integral. Okay. If it's something like a sine function, you have to sum over all the minima. Yeah. Okay. So let's minimize this action then and see what we get, right? So. Let me call phi 1 bar, phi n bar, the configuration of those fields that minimizes the action. Okay, so I find them by calculating the derivative of s with respect to phi I, right, and setting this to 0, or I should write it like this as. Okay, so if I calculate the derivative, what do I get? So the first term gives me 1 over t sum over j, right? J I j phi j bar, right? So the factor of 2 disappears because I have a particular I here, right, and also a particular I here because this is a double sum. And then, so the derivative of log of hyperbolic cosine is tangent, as we discussed before, right? So this gives me minus 1 over t hyperbolic tangent of phi I bar divided by t equals 0, right? Now let me do the following. So this just looks like a matrix, just looks like multiplication of this matrix Jij. This looks like matrix Jij multiplying a vector phi j, right? So let me just multiply both terms in this equation on the left by matrix Jij inverse. This has to be inverse, of course. So let me multiply both sides of this equation by matrix Jij. Okay. So then what I get, and let me cancel also 1 over t's here. So then what I get is phi I bar, right, equals sum over j, j I j hyperbolic tangent of phi j bar divided by t, right? So now I'm going to use the fact that, you know, since all sides of the lattice are equivalent, meaning that this interaction Jij actually does not depend on the site I. It only depends on the distance between sites I and j. This implies that the solutions of this equation will actually not depend on I. Okay? So in fact, phi 1 bar is equal to phi 2 bar and so on equals phi n bar. equals phi bar simply. And then what I get is phi bar is equal to, then I simply have sum over j, jij, right, which we called capital J before when we did mean field theory. So this is capital J, hyperbolic tangent of phi bar divided by t, right? And so indeed, you can see that this exactly coincides with the mean field equation if I write it not for the magnetization, but for the molecular field, which is equal to magnetization times the times J, right? So the mean field equation for the molecular field BM has exactly the same form. Okay. So indeed, mean field theory corresponds to evaluating this this integral in a saddle point approximation. Okay.
So I guess you're assuming something about J here that, you know, dies.
Well, we are assuming that that sum that again that Jij decreases fast enough with the distance between the sides that the sum is finite, gives you a finite value. Okay. Okay. So now, so we will get back to this to mean field theory a little bit later. So now, let me introduce another very important quantity. Yeah.
So, is the assumption that the fluctuations at all the sites, is that part of mean field theory, or is that a distinct assumption? Like, it seems like you put that over there.
No, so here, right, so here I am integrating over all phis, right, over all phis separately. Now, these phi bars, they have to be solutions of this equation, right? And the solutions of this equation are uniform because that's because Jij basically does not depend on I.
Okay. It's the same, the mean, the average,
yeah,
field should be the same. Site.
Yeah,
I see.
Yeah, because, you know, because all the sites are equivalent, then yeah. Okay, so let me introduce another quantity which will play an important role in everything. And so this is called spin-spin correlation function. So let me introduce spin-spin correlation function. Which I will define in the following way. So I'll call this function Jij, capital Gij, sorry. And I will define this as an average of a product of deviation of spin on each side from its average value. Okay, so it's going to be sigma I minus average sigma I times sigma j minus average sigma j. So the reason I want to define correlation function in this way, rather than just average of sigma I times sigma j, right, is the following. The reason is that I want to meet this correlation function to behave similarly, both for t greater than tc and t less than tc, right? Because if I define correlation function in this way, just as a product of sigma I times sigma j, right? So then for temperatures below the critical temperature, right, we get long range order, which means that sigma I develops a component, which is its average, right, which does not depend on site on site index, right? So then this correlation function will develop a constant component, which is basically proportional to the square of the order parameter, right? While above TC, there is no such component, okay? But if I define the correlation function in terms of deviations of the values of the spin from the average values, it's gonna behave in the same way, both below the transition and above the transition, okay?
Sigma I sigma j bracket minus the bracket of sigma I times.
Well, so that's what it is, right? But that's what it's going to be. If I open those brackets, it's going to become simply sigma I sigma j minus sigma I average sigma j average. Exactly. So basically, I'm subtracting. So below TC, I'm going to subtract that constant component that's proportional to just square of the order parameter. Okay? And so the meaning of this function is simple, right? This tells me how fluctuation of the spin at site I is correlated with fluctuation of the spin at some other site, J. Okay? Okay, so let me show the following. So let me take again my Ising model Hamiltonian, so minus 1/2 sum over I and j, j I j, sigma I, sigma j, and let me modify it in the following way. Let me add a term with a site-dependent magnetic field, right? So before we had a term with a uniform magnetic field. Now let me make this magnetic field site dependent, right? It's just going to be a kind of a mathematical device, but in principle, you know, nothing prevents me from applying a field which depends on which is spatially non-uniform, right? So minus sum over I, bi, sigma I, okay? And now what I want to show is that I can calculate that correlation function as derivative, in terms of derivatives of the free energy with respect to that site-dependent magnetic field, okay? So my claim is that Gij is just equal to, so correlation function of the Ising model without that term, in the absence of any external field, is equal to minus T, second derivative of the free energy with respect to Bi and Bj taken at all Bs equal to zero, right? Let me write it like this. Taken at, so that means that I set all BIs on every site to zero. Okay, so let me just show this quickly. This is a very, very straightforward calculation. And that is exact, of course. That does not depend on any approximations. So F is minus T log of the partition function, right? So let me calculate the second derivative. So d2f dbi dbj, right? So this is minus t d2 dbi dbj of log of z. Right, so if I differentiate log of z, I get 1 over z, so I get minus t d d dI, right, of 1 over z d z d b j, right, and then this gives me two terms now when I differentiate. So I get minus t 1 over z d, sorry, d 2z dbi dbj, and then plus t times 1 over z squared, and then dz dbi dz dbj, right? So let me now calculate these derivatives. Oops. Okay, let's go there.
Can I ask? So here, over there, and when you've written down the expression for the Hamiltonian, the BIs are, that is the magnetic field at position at lattice site I.
Yeah.
Right? So in that sense, the BIs are discrete variables. But now you're taking derivatives with respect to BIs.
No. BIs are real variables. They're not discrete. Magnetic field does not have to be, the spins are discrete, right? The spins can only take values plus one and minus one. The magnetic field can take any value. Magnetic fields are not discrete.
This is the value of the magnetic field at position I.
Yeah.
Xi, for example.
Yeah.
But now you take, so isn't, now you've got derivatives with respect to dbi and dbj, but aren't these the same field?
I'm assuming that I can apply a separate field on every side, right?
Okay. So it's not this.
It's not a uniform field. But, of course, in reality, you cannot, if you have a crystal lattice, you cannot apply a separate field to each atom. This is just a mathematical device that will allow me to calculate correlation functions. Formally, I can add anything I want to the Hamiltonian as long as it doesn't violate any general physical principles. It's just math. Let's calculate those derivatives here. My z is sum over all configurations of sigmas e to 1 over 2t sum over I and j, jij, sigma I, sigma j, plus 1 over t sum over I, bi, sigma I, right? So when I take the derivative of z with respect to bi, what this does is that it puts sigma I divided by t downstairs here, right? In front of the exponential. So dz dbi, this is simply equal to sum over sigma I, right? Sigma I divided by t, and then the same exponential. So e to 1 over 2t sum over I and j, jij, sigma I, sigma j, plus 1 over t sum over I, bi, sigma I, right? So therefore, 1 over z times that derivative. So this is nothing but the average value of sigma I divided by t, right? So this is just equal to average of sigma I divided by t. That's how we take the statistical mechanical average, right? So I have the Gibbs distribution rho of sigma, which is equal to e to minus h divided by t, right? And to calculate average of sigma I, what I do is take 1 over z, sum over sigma, sigma I times rho of sigma, right? That's by definition the statistical mechanical average. Okay, so this is just, so therefore, this term is simply gives me sigma I times sigma j divided by t, right? While the second derivative, so when I take the second derivative, I just simply pull, I simply put two sigmas, right? Sigma I times sigma j here in front of the exponential, and that's the average value of sigma I times sigma j. So the whole thing is just equal to so minus 1 over t times the indeed the correlation function. Okay? Yeah.
In the definition we use is the fact that we evaluate the field in all the bi equal to zero. But here
right. So yeah. So what I want is to, you know, as I said, these fields are just a mathematical device. What I really want is to calculate the correlation function in the Ising model in the absence of those fields. Right. So after I take the derivative, I set the fields to zero. Right. So the only reason those fields are in there is so I can take a derivative with respect to them. Okay. Yeah.
Why does it seem like you're off by a factor of minus t?
Sorry.
It's minus t.
So yeah. So there is minus 1 over t, but then what I'm claiming is that gij is minus one of minus t times that derivative, right? Okay. Okay, so the reason this is useful is because now I can go to my functional integral representation of the partition function, add those fields in there, and just in the same way as derivatives of the free energy, I can calculate the correlation function, right? Even though I've already gotten rid of the variables sigma themselves. Okay? Oh, do you still need this, or can I raise it? Okay. So now let me go back to my functional integral form for z, right? But let me add those fields, site-dependent magnetic fields, into the action, right? So I have z equals integral d phi e to minus s of phi, right? And s of phi in the presence of those time-dependent fields, right? So basically, I just have to add fields bi in the argument of the log of hyperbolic cosine. Yes. So if you go back to your if you go back to the mean field theory of the Ising model, right? So we saw there that the external field is just basically added to the molecular field. So the same thing happens here. Okay. So S of phi is just equal to 1 over 2t sum over ij phi I jij inverse phi j. And I have minus sum over I log of twice hyperbolic cosine of phi I plus bi divided by t. So I mean, if you don't see this immediately, just go through the steps of doing Hubbard-Sutton-Lewis transformation for Isaac model, this the bi term included, and you will see this immediately. Okay. Okay. So now we can do the same calculation of so we can calculate the correlation function starting from this functional integral representation for the partition function. Okay, so let's do this calculation. So I have Gij, as we've just seen, it's equal to minus t, second derivative of the free energy with respect to bi and bj taken at all b's equal to 0, right? And this, again, as we've just seen, I can write as a sum of two terms, t squared 1 over z d 2 z dbi dbj taken at b equals 0, and then minus t squared 1 over z squared dz dbi dz dbj, again taken at field equal to 0, right? So to simplify the evaluation of those derivatives, it's convenient to do the following thing, and that's another advantage of this functional integral representation. Since this is just an integral over real variables from minus to plus infinity, I can easily change the integration variables, right? So let me change integration variables in this integral from phi I to phi I minus bi, right? So what this does, what this change of variables does, is that it eliminates bi from the argument of this horrible function, log of hyperbolic cosine, and puts them into this quadratic form, okay? And that makes evaluation of all the derivatives much easier. So then after this change of variables, my S of phi is going to become 1 over 2t sum over I and j phi I minus bi j I j inverse phi j minus bj, right? And this term now does not depend on b, log of twice hyperbolic cosine of just phi I divided by t, right? And then let me get rid of this. So then, so if I take, let's say, d derivative of z with respect to bi taken at b equals 0, right? So the derivative of b of z with respect to bi pulls down this thing, right, in front of the exponential. Right. So what I get is integral over phi, and then I have 1 over t sum over j, right? And so 1/2 disappears for the same reason as before, right? Since I have a particular I both in here and in here, right? This is a double sum. So I have 1 over t sum over j, j I j inverse phi j multiplied by e to minus s of phi, right? Now let me change the variables in this integral once again. Okay? So this change of variables is gonna actually have a physical meaning. So let me introduce, instead of variable phi, another real variable mi, which I will define as precisely this thing. So sum over j, j I j inverse times phi j. So if the physical meaning of phi I is a fluctuating molecular field, the physical meaning of m is the fluctuating magnetization. Okay? And we will see it precisely when we actually calculate the correlation function. So this is fluctuating magnetization, right? So let me write now S in terms of M. So if I write S in terms of M, right, I will just get 1 over 2T sum over I and J, MI, JIJ, MJ, right? Since, you know, it's basically going to be J squared times JIJ inverse, which is going to give me J, and then minus sum over I log of twice hyperbolic cosine, but now in the argument of the hyperbolic cosine, I have a more complicated thing. I have sum over j, j I j, m j, divided by t. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So, in going to that last step, did you already set all the b's to zero? Or did you
I've set the b's to zero here. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Okay. That's okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, these are, you can either represent z, the partition function, in terms of these variables phi, or in terms of variables m. These are just different choices of variable, which are more or less equivalent. Okay. So if I calculate 1 over z dz dbi, taking at b equals 0, right? So what I get is simply 1 over z integral over m. Now, so actually one thing that you got to be careful about with this, with those variable changes, right, is that when you change variables like this, in principle, there is a change in the measure of the integration, right? There is a Jacobian of this transformation that goes into here. But when I calculate these kind of combinations as 1 over z dz dbi, right? That Jacobian cancels between the this term and this term, because they both contain an integral over phi's or over m's, right? But in principle, if you are just changing variables and calculating z, let's say, right, then in principle there is this Jacobian that you have to sometimes worry about. Most of the times you don't. But there is a, you know, important phenomenon in, that we'll probably talk about in quantum field theory, which is called chiral anomaly, for example. So that precisely comes from this kind of change in the integration variables. Okay? So sometimes it's not trivial. But in this case it is. Okay. Okay, so this is just equal to integral over m. So this combination is just mi divided by t. Mi divided by t, and then e to minus s of m, right? Which is again by definition just equal to average value of mi divided by t. Okay? Yeah.
Z here, you mean with the integral over the end, right? In the last.
Yeah.
And one more thing, I guess there should be a minus sign when you calculated dz by dbi.
There should be a minus sign,
but I guess it doesn't matter.
No, so there are two minus signs, right? There is a minus sign here, and then there is a minus sign in here, right? So they cancel. Okay, and so then, you know, so this is basically, again, the same as when we calculated the expectation value of sigma I, right? And so everything else works out in exactly the same way. Okay, so this correlation function then is just equal to expectation value of mi mj minus average of mi times average of mj, okay? So it's in this sense, basically, that mi represents fluctuating magnetization, right? In the sense that, so gij originally was defined as a correlation function of the spins, right? But what we've just shown is that it's also equal to the same correlation function of those variables m. And the same can be shown for all other possible correlation functions, not just this two-point correlation function. Yeah?
So in the case of mean field theory, that magnetization won't depend on the site, right?
Yeah.
So in this case, every time that I go with mean field theory, I cannot calculate non-zero correlation functions.
No, you still can. So if you add this site-dependent magnetic field, then even in mean field theory, order parameter is going to depend on I, right? So that's what we will exactly be doing. We will next calculate this correlation function in the mean field approximation. Okay. But so again, what this shows is that this variable n precisely has the physical meaning of fluctuating magnetization, because this correlation function coincides with the correlation function of the original spins. Okay. Okay. So now let's calculate explicitly this correlation function in the mean field approximation. In the mean field approximation, my z is simply, I approximate z as just e to minus s of m, and I'm going to neglect that contribution from fluctuations, that we will deal with later, right? Where M now is the configuration of M's that minimizes the action, right? So then F, which is equal to minus T times log Z, right? So this is just equal to T times S of M, right? And so explicitly, this is so 1/2 sum over I and j, m I, j I, j, m j, right, minus t sum over I log of twice hyperbolic cosine of sum over j, j I, j, m j, plus bi divided by t, right? And so again, so here, the fact that I'm assuming that mi's actually depend on I is due to the presence of that field, right? If I have an external field that depends on the site index, even the mean field solution is going to depend on the site index, because the lattice is no longer uniform. That site-dependent field breaks the translational symmetry of the lattice. Okay, and so let's then calculate that second derivative now. So if I calculate the first derivative, this simply gives me, so df dbi, right? This is just t 1 over z dz dbi, right? With a minus sign, I guess. Right? And this, as we just saw, right, this is just equal to mi. Right? This is simply mi. Then the second derivative, so g I j, which is minus t d 2 f d b I d b j taken at b equals 0, right? From here, I can write this as just t times the derivative of mi with respect to bj taken at b equals 0. So, you know, so this is another way to think about the meaning of the correlation function, right? I perturb my system of spins by field at site j, right? But then due to correlations, there is a response to that field from magnetization at site I. Okay. Now, so what is MI, right? I find MIs by minimizing that action, right? If I minimize the action, I will just get the same mean field equation we had before, except now with the fields included, right? So MI is just equal to hyperbolic tangent of sum over j, j, I, j, m, j, plus b, I, divided by t, right? So again, so in the absence of those fields, since j, I, j only depend on the distance, the solutions would not depend on I, in fact. Yeah.
Why is this not the average of m?
Because
well, that's the average m already. I'm just so this is the mean field solution, which means that the m's here are the m's that minimize the action. Okay. I've just omitted the bars.
Why is the average m not always zero? Because if we look at the integral, we can always diagonalize j. So then we have like. We have like an even function times an odd function.
The average m is zero in the absence of the field when t is greater than tc, right? I guess one way to think about this is that above tc, and that function here is indeed symmetric around zero, right? While below tc, it's not, right? It develops those two. The minimum at zero becomes a maximum, right? I'm just telling the kind of one-dimensional version of that. And it develops secondary minima at non-zero m. So when you integrate, you don't actually get a cancellation. But you are right that above TC, that's precisely the case. So the function S is basically symmetric around zero. And so if you integrate, you just get zero average. So what we have to do now is take a derivative of this hyperbolic tangent function with respect to bj, right? So gij is equal to t times d bj of hyperbolic tangent of sum over I and j, sum over j, j I j m j plus b I divided by t, right? So when I take this derivative, this gives me the following. So I always get 1 over t, which cancels this t, right? Then I get a delta ij term from here, right? So if this I happens to be equal to j, right? Then I get 1 from differentiating this b. Otherwise, I get 0. So I get delta ij, right? And then here I get plus So this index, of course, has to be different from j, right? I have both I and j fixed, so that summation index has to be something else. Let me call this L, I L M L, right? And so then I have plus sum over L. So J I L D M L D B j, right, taken at b equals 0, and then times the derivative of the tangent, which is 1 minus tangent hyperbolic squared, okay? So this is times 1 minus hyperbolic tangent squared of, again, sum over L, j I L m L, taken at b equals 0, divided by t. right? And this is nothing but mi squared, right? Just from here. So this is just mi squared. Okay? And this is nothing but j g l j, right? So then I get the following equation for g. I have g I j equals to delta I j plus sum over l j I l g l j times 1 minus mi squared. Okay? So this is the equation that I have to solve to find the correlation function. And let me just for simplicity do this for t greater than tc, right? So in this case, the average value, the value of m that minimizes the action is equal to 0, right? And at this point, I can also actually lose the site index, because once I take the external field to 0, the mean field value of magnetization becomes independent of the site index. But it's going to be 0 anyway. So in this case, m is equal to 0, right? And then the equation becomes simply this equals to the square bracket, right? Let me rewrite this in the following form. So let me write this equation in the following way. Sum over L delta I L minus 1 over T J I L times G L J is equal to delta I j, right? So in this form, you see that this function g basically has the meaning of Green's function of this operator on the lattice. Okay. 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 So now the question is, how do we solve this? Right. So whenever we have, what we're going to use to solve this is the translational symmetry of the lattice, right? So whenever we have something that's translationally symmetric, we can solve it by Fourier transform, right? So we solve this by lattice Fourier transform. So let me define this Fourier transform. So I will write, let's say, mi as 1 over root n, where n is the number of sites, sum over k, where k is a wave vectors, phi k, oh, sorry, mk, e to I k dot r I. So in principle, this k here, the wave vector, can take any value, right? M does not have to be a periodic function, so in principle, I should have an integral over k. However, it's usually convenient to use the following trick. So I'll assume that my lattice here is finite, right? And I will use what's called periodic boundary conditions. So you'll see more of them in condensed matter physics. Yeah, they're very convenient. Periodic boundary conditions, meaning that, so I'll assume that M of Ri, which is the same as Mi, so Ri are just radius vectors of sites I on the lattice, right? I'll assume that these are the same as M of Ri plus L, where L is going to be the size of my lattice. And I'll assume that the lattice has a form of a cube of size L in all directions, times, let me call this mu. So mu is going to be basis directions on the lattice, so x, y, or z, for example, in three dimensions. Okay. So mu are, you know, x hat, y hat, z hat. Right? So what does this mean? This basically, periodic boundary conditions basically means that I'm assuming that my lattice actually has a form of a torus. Right? So for any point on the lattice, if I add the circumference of the torus, right, I come back to the same point. So why would I do that? It's simple convenience, right? So the reasoning is that if I have a very large system, it really doesn't matter what boundary conditions I use as far as the bulk properties of the system are concerned. Something bad happened there.
Sir, can you please explain again how it's a torus?
Well, because so let's do this in one dimension, right? So I have my lattice here. And so I have 8 sites. So my n is equal to 8, right? What I'm saying here is that if I take any site of the lattice, right? And if I add 8 to it, I'm eight steps to it, I'm going to get back to the same site, right? So in one dimension, this means that I am, you know, originally, let's say I started from a linear chain, right? But I've bent it into a ring, into a circle. So if I do this in two dimensions, right, I'm bending both in x direction and y direction, this will give me the usual three-dimensional torus, or two-dimensional torus in three dimensions. Now, if I do this with 3D lattice, this is going to give me something that I cannot imagine, but it's a three-dimensional torus, I guess, in four dimensions. Yeah?
Like, that picture makes sense, but what's the conceptual problem if you just associate it with, like, a sphere instead? Because, like, you can go around, like, and you get back, and you can go up and down.
Well, no. So on a sphere, I would not get that, right? What I want is that for any, so you know, let's say originally, again, I now do this in two dimensions, right? So I have my lattice in two dimensions. And I want a property that, you know, if I start from any point, right, if I go, and let's say, so the total number of steps here is again, something. 10 here and 10 here. So if I add 10 steps in this direction or 10 steps in this direction, I get back to the same point, right? That's exactly the torus, right? It's not going to be a sphere.
Oh, is that? Yeah. Okay, that makes more sense.
This is pretty much the, by definition,
like
a torus.
The torus work, I just didn't see why it was unique with the torus.
Yeah, no, it has to be torus, yeah. Yeah.
So I'm a little confused with your Fourier transform there. Those M sub i's, those are discrete M's on the lattice, whereas you also wrote M sub k's, where those are different objects, those are...
I'm just using the same letter for Fourier transform of M sub I, right?
Those guys are some continuous function.
In principle, yeah, this is a continuous function of k. So I'm using that trick to make k discrete, just so I can write sums in terms of instead of integrals. It just makes writing easier.
So this m r sub I that you've written as r sub I plus some l times mu, that
right.
L times mu is somehow discrete going between lattice points, yeah?
Yeah. So the lattice is discrete, of course. Yeah.
Okay, so that l is some integer.
L is just the So the lattice, of course, has let's write what those RIs are explicitly, right? So RIs, I can write in the following way as sum again over mu, right? Some integer which I will write as ni mu times a, where a is going to be the distance between nearest neighbor points on the lattice constant, right? Times mu, right? What is this saying? And ni mu is just an integer. And mu is integer. So what this is saying basically is that to get to any point of the lattice, right? From, let's say, origin, so I pick one point to be the origin, right? To get to any point of the lattice from the origin, I have to take, you know, n steps times a, where a is the lattice constant, in a particular direction, right? So I take ni x steps in the x direction, ni y steps in the y direction, and that gives me this particular point, right? So this L here is really the linear size of the lattice. So this is A times whatever is the total number of steps that you have to go to get from one side of the lattice to the other. And now we are simply bending that lattice into a torus, okay? Yeah, sorry. I mean, I should have asked to actually cover this on the in one of your tutorials before the lecture, but I forgot. So we have to do it here. So why does this imply that k's have to be discrete? Now, so if I plug this this condition into here, right? This can only be satisfied if e to I k dot ri, right, is equal to e to I k dot ri plus l mu for any k, right? If this is satisfied for any k, then if and only if this is satisfied for any k, my periodic boundary conditions are going to be satisfied, right? But this in turn can only be true if e to I k dot mu times l, right, is always equal to 1 for any k, right? Which means that k dot mu, which is simply a component of k in one of the basis directions, mu, so I'll call this k sub mu. So this has to be equal to 2 pi times some integer, and mu divided by L, right? Then k dot mu times L is always 2 pi times an integer, and e to 2 pi I times an integer is always 1, right? So indeed, the once we apply those periodic boundary conditions, the components of k become discrete, and so they vary, they change with this step. 2 pi divided by the size of the system in every direction, right? And if we take the size of the system to be very large, you know, that step becomes smaller and smaller, and so it's as good as k being continuous. Now, another important thing is that since...
isn't that a sum over mu instead? That should be a sum
over mu. Where? No, this has to... No, so this has to be true for every mu separately, right? So this is not... It's not a sum here. This has to be true, you know, so this... this relation has to be true for every component, for every direction separately, okay?
But that, when you look at that, that suggests, so k dot mu is a sum over k.
No, k dot mu is just a component of k, right? So this is
okay,
like k dot x hat. This is just kx,
okay.
The component of k along the x direction, yeah.
Is there a maximum value for k mu?
Yeah, exactly, so that's what I'm coming to. So the fact that those r's here are not continuous but take discrete values on the side of the lattice actually imply that there is also a maximum value of k. There is a finite range of the values of k that we have to take into account, and that's called the first Brillouin zone, which you will hear a lot about in condensed matter physics. Why is this the case? K's have to be restricted in the following interval, in the interval from minus pi over a, k mu, less or equal to pi over a, right? And the reason is that, so if you just look here, right, you see that if I shift k mu by the length, by the integer multiple of the length of this interval, which is 2 pi divided by a, right? So if I shift k mu by k mu plus 2 pi times any integer n divided by a, that exponential will not in fact change, okay? So the way to see this is the following. So let me calculate k dot ri, right? So I have k dot, and ri I can write in this way, as sum over mu. So ni mu times a times mu, right? And now let me change one particular component of a. Let me call this, let's just actually do this. Let me call this integer m sub mu, okay? And so let me change, shift every component of k by this amount, right? So I'll have k mu plus 2 pi m sub mu divided by a times mu. I have to have sum here, so sum over mu, and then n I mu times a, right? So this gives me sum over mu k mu n I mu times a, and this is nothing but the original k dot r I, right? Plus I have sum over mu 2 pi times m mu times n I mu, and this is simply 2 pi times an integer, right? Because this is 2 pi times sum of products of integers. And then when I take this k dot r I into the exponential, when I take e to I k dot r I, this simply gives me e to 2 pi I times some integer, which is equal to 1, right? Therefore, when I shift k by any such amount, right, that doesn't give me anything anything different, right? I can shift, I can shift k here by any amount like this, and nothing is going to change, right? So the physically distinct values of k can be restricted to this interval here, which is called the first Brillouin zone. Okay. So this is basically a property of all lattice Fourier transforms. Okay. The property of all lattice Fourier transforms that the physically distinct values of the wave vector are restricted to a finite volume in momentum space, in the wave vector space. So the shape of that volume, of course, depends on the geometry of the lattice. In our case, I'm assuming that the lattice is cubic. So then that volume is just a cube of this size, of size 2 pi over a in every direction in the wave vector space. Okay? So you should probably have more exposure to this in tutorials. I forgot to do this before the lecture. And you will see this, as I said, a lot in condensed matter physics. Okay. Anyway, so the Fourier transforms of all these variables on the lattice are defined in this way, as sums over k, which are restricted to this first Brillouin zone, and it's a sum, the values of k are discrete, because we've assumed periodic boundary conditions. And that's a pure convenience. I mean, the Brillouin zone is physical, that's important, but the fact that values of k are discrete, that's just a matter of convenience. And in fact, in what follows, we will be frequently changing between sums and integrals. So basically, the point is that when you have a general expression in terms of some summation over k, it's convenient to have a sum over k. But when you actually want to evaluate that sum explicitly, and then it's convenient to transform to an integral. Okay, so we can similarly define Fourier transforms of the correlation function and of J, right? So I have G I J equals 1 over N sum over Q. So let me call those wave vectors Q. G of Q E to I Q dot R I minus R J, right? So why do I have a factor 1 over n here? So let me calculate the inverse Fourier transform to get the g of q. Right? So g of q is going to be equal to also 1 over n, sum over both I and j, g I j, same exponential but with a minus sign, e to minus I q dot r I minus r j, right? And let me plug in this expression for g I j now, right, and show that I indeed get g of q. Okay, so this is equal to 1 over m sum over I and j e to minus I q dot r I minus r j. And then I have 1 over m sum over some q prime g of q prime e to I q prime dot r I minus r j, right? And now I'm going to use the following property that, and this is pretty much the only thing you need to know when you do Fourier transforms, that 1 over n sum over I of E to minus I. So let me take all the terms here, collect all the factors here which depend on Ri, right? So I have 1 over n sum over I E to minus I Q minus Q prime dot Ri. Okay? Sorry? The I here is just the imaginary unity. It's not the site index. Sorry. So that sum is equal to Kronecker delta of Q and Q prime. So that pretty much is the only thing one needs to know when doing Fourier transforms. Okay. So that means that when I take sum over I here, right, that gives me one over n, right, sum over j, and then just delta of q and q prime, right? Because once I sum over I, that already sets q equal to q prime, and so only the dependence on rj then disappears, right? And then so I have just 1 over n sum over j, which gives me n. G of q prime. So this is just equal to g. And I have also sum over q and q prime, sum over q prime. Okay. So this gives me, and this indeed gives me g of q. Okay. Is this clear? So you have to do these manipulations several times to get used to them, but it's really simple otherwise. Okay, so next time, tomorrow, I guess we will take Fourier transform of this equation and solve it and find the correlation function, okay?